Would I use Atari Writer? Ah, I keep saying that.
Goodbye. Immerse and Nasty, Atari 8-Bit Productivity Podcast, Season 1, Episode 2.
Welcome back. I'm glad you've decided to continue to listen. In this episode, the second overall, I'm featuring the Letter Perfect Word Processor from LJK Enterprises. This episode includes a bonus at the end, so stay tuned. But first...
Corrections.
Yeah, that's right. Who knew I'd get one fact wrong, probably the most important fact wrong, right out of the gate. Dolt! Atari Word Processor was not the first word processor for the Atari 8-bit line of computers. It wasn't even second. It was third. Now, with that said, I will say that it was the second one announced. So what was the first word processor for the Atari 8-bits, you ask? Well, it goes to this episode's feature, Letter Perfect.
Technical data.
Letter Perfect was released in 1980 by LJK Enterprises. It was programmed by Ken Leonardi. It was initially distributed on diskette and later was distributed on a cartridge as well. The part number for diskette was 2001. The part number for the cartridge was 2005. It was a commercial license and it used the keyboard controller. It was compatible with all lines of the Atari computer, 400, 800, XL, and XE. It required 24K of memory, and the original price was $149. Now, an adjusted price today, that's $402.47. And Atari Mania lists the rarity as an 8. The product on diskette was not copy protected. It was menu driven. You could not customize the colors. It did not automatically back up your files. It did have cut and paste. It did not have an undo. All versions had type over, macros were not supported, mail merge was included in the later versions and was optional in the early versions. It did have a spell checker in the later versions included as well, and was also optional in the early versions. There was no print preview, it had extensive search and replace abilities, it did not offer true descenders on the screen, it did not offer two-column mode, it did support proportional spacing, and it did support 80 columns in several different ways. There was no horizontal scroll. It did support both a header and a footer, and it did support page numbering. The maximum size of a document in the early versions was 36K. In the later versions, it was a little bit lower at 28K, but that was due to the inclusion of mail merge and spell check. As I stated in the corrections, Letter Perfect was the first word processor released for the Atari 8-bit computers. It was first by a long margin. It was basically on the market before the Atari 8-bit computers were widely available. If you followed your Atari history, you know that Atari announced and showed the 400 and 800 computers at the Winter CES show of 1979 in Las Vegas. But it wasn't until November of 1979 that they actually started shipping the units. Letter Perfect was released in early 1980 on disk and in mid-1980 on cartridge. Now how's that for timely market entry? Okay, so continuing the practice of using the program to actually write my notes, I did so with Letter Perfect as well. Now, I was forced to use the latest version, which is 6, because I could not get the insert mode to work on the early versions, leaving only the option of type over mode. So, have you ever tried editing a long document without using insert? Nah, I didn't think so. Originally, I was going to discuss the early versions and the later versions and then note the differences, but because of the insert issue, I'm not going to be able to do that. I can, however, describe a few of the differences, though. First, the menus are different. In the early versions, you use the less than and greater than keys to move the menu selection, and then you press return to select it. In the later versions, you can do that, but you can also just press the first letter of the menu option to select it as well. And one other thing to note is that the menus are in proper case instead of all caps in the later versions. Second, using the first version on a stock 48K Atari 800, you get a rather amazing 36,671 bytes free. Using the later version on a stock 128K Atari 130XE, you only get 28,671 bytes free. The same goes for a stock Atari 800XL. It's a rather large difference, but it's due to the included features of the later version. And third, with the later versions, SpellPerfect is included as well, which is part of the reason why there's less memory to work with. Now, unlike the standalone version of SpellPerfect, the included version doesn't allow you to add to the dictionary or create your own. On the plus side, you won't need to exit the word processor just to run a spell checker on your work, then to have to exit the spell checker and return to the word processor to continue editing. The downside to this is that you must use the SpellPerfect dictionary disk. A bit about the manual before getting into the program itself. It's 92 pages long, it's well written, and comes with a lot of examples and a tutorial. I had no trouble reading how to do something and then immediately picking it up. Remembering all the commands is another story. I'll talk about that soon. The manual included several worksheets for printer definitions, mainly for the popular printers of the time. It also included several blank ones so that you could create your own printer definitions. The manual also included reference pages for the dot widths of every character for the printer supported out of the box. This is useful for doing the dot spacing that the program supports. On top of that, you also get two reference cards with all the commands, which you'll definitely need. All right, so let's talk about all those commands now. LetterPerfect has a command attached to just about every key with control and with shift. This is nice for convenience of not having to go through a menu to do something like search and replace. However, many of them are not intuitive, such as Control 5 to delete the current line. I was constantly looking up commands. I suppose that with time you would remember those commands that mix well with your editing style. Rather than list out every command and what it does, I'm just going to give an overview of the feature set, that way you'll understand what it's capable of. And if you are interested in those commands, you can refer to the show notes on the website to get them. Anytime you're editing a document, you can always press Escape. That takes you back to the main menu, where you find all your major functions, such as Load, Save, Print, Edit, Change Configuration, etc. Navigation is one area that LetterPerfect does not fall short on. There are many ways to navigate around the document. You can go to the beginning and the end of the line. You can go to the top of the page, the bottom of the page. You can go to the next screen, the previous screen. You can go to the top of the text, the bottom of the text. You can even go to the next paragraph if you want. And if that's not enough, there are also word-centric commands like to move next and previous word and delete next and previous word. And of course, the cursor keys do what you would expect. All right, cut and paste. Now, I'm so used to working with modern word processors where you have Alt-C and Alt-V to copy and paste, or Control-C, Control-V if you're on Windows, that I've managed to easily mangle many a documents working with these old word processors that are non-GUI based and before really any standards were around the keys that are assigned to them. So with that, I'm going to spend a few minutes talking in detail about the cut and paste implementation in LetterPerfect. To use cut and paste, you have to familiarize yourself with Control-D. This sets a delimiter, or a marker, and markers are the basis for all block operations within LetterPerfect. Before you can paste anything, first you have to fill the copy buffer. Now there are two ways to do this. One, you can copy text between the cursor and the delimiter into the buffer, or two, you can move the text between the cursor and the delimiter into the buffer. The latter actually removes your text from the document. Now that the copy buffer has text in it, you can paste it in one of two ways. Both ways insert the text at the current cursor location. However, the first one leaves the text in the copy buffer. The second one removes the text from the copy buffer when it's done. On to search and replace. Search and replace are easily remembered with Control-S and Control-R respectively. That's a nice touch. They work well enough, but you must read the documentation or you're never going to figure this out. With both search and replace, you're first asked for what you want to search for. In the case of replace, you're asked what you want to replace it with as well. Now the tricky part. It will search for the word, make a keyboard click sound, and then stop. It's not hung up, it's actually waiting on you. So if you just did a search, press space to find the next occurrence. If you did a replace, press space to replace the word, or return to skip it. Either way, it continues on at the next occurrence. LetterPerfect does include a global replace as well, using the Control Caps key. This replaces every matching occurrence without prompting you. And I do have a complaint about all the search capabilities a little later on. An episode on word processing wouldn't be complete without a word about formatting, so let's get to that right now. LetterPerfect provides a standard fare of features like centering, bold, underline, header, footer, and full justification, just to name a few. Now, even though the header and footer are limited to one line, they do have one nice feature in that they allow full formatting of the line. There was one interesting touch in the formatting department. You get the ability to embed control codes for your printer. Now, this could be useful if you wanted to do something special that the printer driver didn't support, but your printer did. Aside from the standard gamut of making things look special at printing, the page layout controls work especially well conceived. One in particular that I was surprised to find is conditional page breaking. If you have a paragraph that you didn't want split, you can place a marker both before and after it, and it prevents that from splitting at the page break. On top of that, you can also force a new page with Control P. Perfect. No pun intended. Another cool feature that they included was the ability to embed a halt printer command using Control V. So what good is that? Well, let's say you want to print out some particular text in a different color. You put the halt printer command in before the text, then when it prints, the printer stops, you swap out the ribbon, it continues to print that, it runs into the next halt printer command, and you switch the printer ribbon back out for the remainder of the document. Next, and I really like this one, you can embed comments that won't be printed using Control F and then using all capital letters on the line. Very, very cool. And one last thing regarding formatting that's worth mentioning. You can turn on a ruler line that shows at the top of the screen by pressing Control T. This replaces the single line status bar at the top. You can also change the tab stops to your liking, which makes it easy to create multiple column lists that are properly aligned. Onward. What good's a word processor if you're not going to print? First, you can only print the file that's in memory. You can't print a file from disk directly, so you have to load it from disk first. Not a big deal, but it's worth mentioning. LetterPerfect does supply you with plenty of print options. Full range control and number of copies are both supported. When you print a document, it will ask you for copies and pages. This accepts a three-number sequence separated by commas. The first is a number of copies, the second is the page to start on, and the third is the page to stop on. By default, it'll print one copy of all pages. This is a nice touch if you need to only print one page because you edited one paragraph or maybe just misspelled one word. Another nice feature is the ability to cancel a print at any time by pressing Escape. So if you see the output isn't coming out like you want it, you don't have to waste your paper or ribbon waiting for it to complete. One last thing worth mentioning regarding printing. You can chain files together so they print as one. I'll talk about this in just a moment. I've created my document, now what? You gotta save it, man. You gotta save it. So let me talk briefly about disks and files. LetterPerfect used what was often referred to as LJK DOS under the covers. So what this meant was, their disks were not compatible with standard Atari DOS disks, so you couldn't easily swap files back and forth. LJK did, however, provide a disk utility package, which allowed you to copy files back and forth from their disk to Atari DOS disks. One interesting fact about the DOS underpinning the product is that it's case sensitive, so a lowercase file name is actually different from an uppercase file name. Was that a first? I don't know, maybe. Now this next thing is pretty cool. I mentioned this earlier and it's called file chaining. Let's assume you have a very large document that overflows the edit buffer several times over. So the only way that you're able to create it is to create multiple files and maybe this is for a thesis or a short book. At the end of each of these documents, you'll create an empty line and press Ctrl V and then the double quote mark. Then you enter the name of the file that is next in the document chain. This allows you to print a large multi-file documents with one single command. Now that doesn't sound like a big deal, but back then when your printer only printed 20, 30, 40 characters per second, it could take a very long time to print a stack of paper. And you certainly wouldn't want to be babysitting the computer going and printing each section.
Summary.
Overall, I found LetterPerfect to be a superb word processor. The features and design at such an early stage in the Atari software market set the bar pretty high for anyone entering the market after LJK. With such a high bar, competing products entering the market would easily be labeled either as a word processor by having similar features, or merely as a text editor. Now that doesn't mean that text editors are a bad thing, but there are clear differences between the types of the two products. If I put on my 1980 or release date shoes and had to choose between LetterPerfect and nothing, well, LetterPerfect would be the product to pick. It's a no-brainer. After all, remember at the time, there was no competing products. Even if you consider the competitors from 1986, LetterPerfect would be a strong contender as a go-to word processor. From a modern retro computing perspective, having to choose between LetterPerfect and other products, well, I guess I haven't featured enough of them to make that call. I could take a stab at it with what I remember from back then. However, I want the playing field to be level and fair, so I'm only going to compare against others that I've also featured. LetterPerfect is going to be hard to beat, as the features it has are, well, pretty darn good. I can say that of those I have featured, that LetterPerfect is my preferred choice. Wait a minute. Did I feature another one already? Maybe it wasn't worth remembering. I had a hard time for a bit rating because I wanted to give this full 8 bits, but because of the small complaints that I had with it, I'm going to have to go with 7. I'm going to reserve 8 bits for products that provide all the features and I have really no complaints with.
Fun facts.
First, Version 2 was mistakenly advertised as being compatible with Atari DOS. It was also stated to run on 16K Atari 400s. Second, LJK had a $30 upgrade fee for a newer version, but they allowed you to keep the old disk. And finally, LJK Enterprises is still currently doing business in Missouri. Today they sell a complete order entry system, do web hosting, and network services, among other things. Congratulations, you just made it to the bonus level. I said the interviews might not be off the plate, and turns out they were not. On October 6th of 2014, I had the opportunity to speak with Ken Leonardi of LJK Enterprises in St. Louis, Missouri. Ken founded LJK in 1978. He declined to have a recorded interview, but we spent a good hour and a half talking on the phone, as well as a long string of email inquiries back and forth. So rather than read the questions and the responses as myself, I decided I would wrap it up into a little story and tell it that way. So with that, here we go. LJK was the manufacturer of LetterPerfect, DataPerfect, and SpellPerfect for the Atari 8-bit and the Apple computer lines, as well as Edit 6502. And as stated, Ken founded LJK in 1978. LLCs did not exist back then, so the filing was a registration of fictitious name. LJK would become incorporated on March 2, 1980. A gentleman named Ken Berry was brought on as a partner to handle the marketing side of things. Ken Leonardi wrote LetterPerfect and DataPerfect. By the time SpellPerfect came to be, LJK had been developing and growing quickly. A staff of a few programmers built SpellPerfect, but Ken had designed them all. Prior to entering the Atari market, LJK already had products on the market for the Apple computers. LJK entered the Atari market after being contacted by Joe Dahlem of CDC Associates, which was one of LJK's distributors. CDC Associates was about to start selling Atari computers when they were released. The distributor wanted LetterPerfect on the Atari, which LJK already had for the Apple. This was in early 1980 before the Atari computers were readily available. Long before the Winter CES show of January 81, where Atari announced the Atari word processor. When development began, LJK received Atari 800, serial number 4. There was something very memorable about this. It didn't work. So another unit had to be sent. It was around this time that LJK discovered that Atari was internally developing its own word processor, the Atari Word Processor. The race to market was on. I was surprised to learn that it only took a few weeks to create the Atari version of Letter Perfect. Since LJK did not have Edit 6502 on the Atari at the time, it was developed using Edit 6502 on an Apple. The output was printed and the hex machine code instructions were entered on the Atari by hand. With a working prototype on disk, Ken flew to San Jose, California to meet with Ken Schaefer from Atari about distribution of Letter Perfect. Keith was unavailable once he arrived. LJK later found out that negotiations had broken down with Visa Corp for distribution of Visa Calc, and this made Atari decide not to distribute third-party software, at least not initially. LJK entered into agreements with nationwide distributors to solve this problem. At the 1980 summer CES show in Chicago, Atari had eagerly been awaiting LJK's arrival because Letter Perfect was already on the market in disk form. When LJK arrived, they arrived with a bombshell, Letter Perfect on cartridge. This was before Atari Word Processor was released, thus making Letter Perfect the first word processor for the Atari 8-bit computers. At the show, the prototype Letter Perfect cartridge was demoed on an Atari 400 with only 4K of memory. During the early 80s, many developers were cashing in on games, but LJK wanted to make a difference by doing something positive. This was the infancy of home computing market, and Ken wanted a reason to keep a computer on his desk. Making productivity software filled that need. There were 6 major releases of Letter Perfect between 1980 and 1986. Each came with improvements. Each improvement was driven by Ken's desire to create a better user experience. In 1982, one of LJK's advertisers misunderstood some information and falsely represented version 2 of Letter Perfect in print. They advertised version 2, part number 2001, the disk-based version, as being compatible with Atari DOS. It was not. More on that in a moment. The last versions of Letter Perfect included Spell Perfect and Mail Merge. This was done to prevent the user from having to swap programs just to check spelling. It came at the cost of available free memory, which was offset to some degree by it being able to use the full 64K of the XL machines. An interesting note is that Atari wanted LJK to ship Letter Perfect on a 16K cartridge, even though it just fit on an 8K cartridge. Overall, the products created by LJK got good reviews. The one item that LJK kept hearing about was the incompatibility with Atari DOS. There were constant, and still are, references to LJK DOS, a product that never existed. Ken thinks in retrospect it might have been a good idea to release a DOS. The reason LJK products were not compatible with Atari DOS is simple. Atari DOS didn't allow for random access within a file, a problem Ken recognized early on. He resolved it by writing his own disk routines and using those at the core of his products. To combat the compatibility problem, LJK released a utility disk which enabled you to copy files to and from LJK disks and Atari DOS formatted disks. One uncommon feature of Letter Perfect was the support for Bit3 and Austin Franklin 80-column cards. A fun fact here is that Bit3 was asked by LJK to create the 80-column card for the Atari. Interestingly, LJK chose Bit3 because they were in the same hometown. Subsequently, Letter Perfect was offered with the card, as well as being bundled with the Austin Franklin solution. Though advertised, a version supporting Atari's XEP80 interface was never created due to market timing. By the time Spell Perfect was developed, LJK had a team of programmers. Ken tested each one before hiring them. None of them ever passed his test. Those that he hired would deem the test child's play within a week of working for LJK. LJK was writing very efficient and lean code, to say the least. Spell Perfect will be covered in detail in another episode. However, the dictionary included 16,000 words initially and grew in time to over 30,000. There wasn't an internet to pull a list of words from, so the list was compiled internally by LJK. Ken let me in on a little-known secret. As part of the Letter Perfect tutorial, there was a file that came on the disk that was supposed to be deleted. In early versions, this file had many colorful words in it, thanks to the wily team of programmers. It was found and cleaned up, but not before some were shipped to customers, of which some actually opened the file to see what it was prior to deleting it, and got a very unpleasant surprise. Data Perfect was released about 6 months after Letter Perfect. It was brought to market fairly robust and only went through about 3 revisions. Ken didn't recall exactly what they were, but speculates the big ones were 80-column support and expanded memory support. I'll have another feature on this in another episode. Ken did say the longest part about creating Data Perfect was coming up with a name. The simplest part, but in this case, turned out to be the hardest part. It was initially going to be called Letter Perfect Database. One of the highest acclaimed aspects of Data Perfect was its speed. LJK implemented a design which loaded as much of the data file into memory as possible. A special chunking or paging algorithm had been developed, and also using the random access file routines LJK created, sped up any needed disk operations. The outcome was being able to do a sort in 5 to 10 minutes versus upwards of 12 hours. LJK also marketed a product called Simply Perfect. This was an all-in-one product that included Letter Perfect, Data Perfect, and Spell Perfect. However, it only existed for the Apple computers. Oddly, I can't find anything on the internet about this software. At its high point, LJK commanded a whopping 65% market share for word processors on the Atari, and in 1983 even won a Clio Award for one of its advertisements. Between 1984 and 1985, LJK was in negotiations with Atari to purchase and distribute Letter Perfect. However, an agreement could not be reached. In 1986, the Atari 8-bit market was starting to die. LJK was also ready to get out of the market and sell off its names. They entered negotiations with some of Word Perfect Corporation's competitors to acquire the Perfect line of software, but were also unable to reach any agreements. The contracts and negotiations were tough. LJK then entered negotiations with Word Perfect Corporation itself and eventually came to an agreement. The Perfect names were sold to them in 1986. This was LJK's official exit from the Atari software market. After Word Perfect acquired the naming rights, at one point, Ken mistakenly became mixed up with a legal case in which Word Perfect was suing the maker of Tax Perfect, thinking that they now owned anything perfect. In 1990, WordPerfect released a stripped-down version of their staple product, WordPerfect, using the Letter Perfect name. This version was aimed at the home and student market with a low price tag and a low feature set. It wasn't well received and was ultimately dropped. Ken never saw WordPerfect's Letter Perfect and couldn't comment on it. I asked Ken if he could travel back to 1980 or 81 to tell his young self anything about the next 5 or 6 years. What would it be? He had this to say. There was a lot of venture capital being thrown around, but LJK always refused because he didn't want to give up control. In retrospect, he said he might have taken some towards the end, but overall he wouldn't have changed anything as he was very happy with the route LJK took and the accomplishments they made. LJK set out to make a difference, and they clearly did. Ken had great things to say about the products. He truly believes in them and feels that they were top quality, evidenced by the market share mentioned earlier. He felt the time spent in the Atari market was time well spent with great overall experience. After LJK exited the market, Ken took a few years off, only doing some updates mainly for the bundled versions of Letter Perfect. LJK was rekindled when Ken was asked to write software for optical lens production. This grew into express orders and includes accounts payable and receivable, along with general ledger and product support. Ken was very humble about the work that LJK did back then. The dedication put into the product shows. Ultimately, they were very happy with what they made. And on an interesting side note, he still uses Edit 6502, but on his PC. Ken also told me that before LJK left the market, they had developed a program called EGO, short for Easy Game Originator, which was a graphical OS for the Atari 8-bit and Apple computers. Sadly, it was never brought to market for any platform. The interview concludes with him relaying a funny story about Letter Perfect. He said that once they got a call from a lady that had purchased Letter Perfect. After receiving it, she plugged it into the computer and waited, and waited, and waited, and waited. Then she finally called them to complain that after sitting there for the longest time, it had yet to write a single letter. Ha ha!
Special thanks.
I'd like to thank Ken Leonardi of LJK Enterprises for putting up with all my questions and having the patience to listen to me and provide all the valuable information he did for the interview. I'd also like to thank you for listening and providing support for this podcast. Thank you.
Contact information.
The show notes can be found on inverseataskey.info. It can be found on iTunes using the search term Ataskey or Atari. It can be found on Facebook at facebook.com/inverseataskey. And you can also follow on Twitter with @inverseataskey. To leave comments or suggestions, you can email wade@inverseataskey.info or inverseataskey@icloud.com. As always, thanks for listening and stay tuned for the next episode. I suppose that with time you would remember those commands that mixmel? LetterPerfect also includes the ability to do what? A special chunking or paging algorithm?
Goodbye.
I actually still have it. A Casio FX9750G Plus. Both of these had a pseudo basic-ish command set with if-then-else support, loops, and subroutines. And I've also had a Casio FX702P, which had a full basic interpreter. You're given enough program flow constructs that you can actually do without formal if-then-else clauses, so it's really workable the way it is. The one thing that I did have a problem with, as far as programming goes, is there's no way to display something meaningful for user input other than a string of numbers, which is also going to alter the X register or your accumulator. So you have to take precautions to save and load the X register before and after input. A prompt function would have been nice had they made that available to you. And there's also no way to label the memory locations. So between these two, what that means is you have to have some instructions for what to input, when to input it, and what the output means, and what the memory locations mean if you stick things in those memory locations. So the biggest complaint I have with this is that the editor really sucks wind. You have to manually step through all the instructions, and when you're inserting and deleting, it really does take a toll on you when you're having to constantly adjust where the program logic continues, because as you insert and delete, it breaks your go-tos because those instructions move on the memory locations. So it's best to plan this all out on paper, then input it at one time, save it to disk, print it out, check it again, return, re-enter the whole thing, and then just keep doing that whole cycle. At the editor, I can't say enough about how poorly it is implemented compared to other editors. The next thing I didn't like is when you are getting input from the user. The program stops and the user has to put in their input, press enter, and then you have to press shift at or use the CON instruction to continue the program. What it really should have done is once the user pressed enter to submit their input, is the program should have continued on at that point. The last complaint I have has to do with the input parser. Now the problems are specifically in hex mode. Because the letter A triggers the ABS function, you can't enter 5 plus A, but you can enter A plus 5, and it will still trigger the ABS function, but it will give you the proper result. So there's another problem entering hex values in general when you're in hex mode. For instance, any hex value starting with a letter cannot be entered. It dies at the second digit with error, not a valid command or number. But you can enter hex numbers ending with letters, such as 7F. Overall, I give Atari Calculator a bit rating of 6. I couldn't give it any higher due to the input problems and the editor. I really can't say enough about how poor that editor is. Oh, I don't miss it. So if it was 1981, would I use this program? I'm not sure. It depends. If I needed to save the output from several different samples of data and then import them into a spreadsheet, I might consider doing it. But with the availability and ease of use of the handheld calculators of the time, I might just resort to that. Now today, would I use it? Definitely no. Today's calculators are much too sophisticated and a lot easier to use.
Fun facts.
First, the manual says to remove the cartridge, but the diagram shows an insert. Originally, this program was supposed to be released on cartridge, so they probably updated the text but didn't update the image, but still fun to look at. You can see an image of it on the website. And two, the package shipped with not only the manual and program disk, but also a blank disk. Maybe that was Atari apologizing for being 2 years late.
Listener feedback.
And now for some listener feedback. I've been holding off on this until I had a few episodes under my belt, and now I think it's time to go ahead and get started with it. So first, KLund1 on the InVersiTasky website wrote in regarding the Season 1, Episode 1 Atari Word Processor. He says, "Good review, good podcast. The idea of an application podcast is perfect for me. I like Atari games, but his applications, as you stated, are where the work gets done. I have been collecting 8-bit and ST application software for years and have quite a collection. I used Atari Word Processor for several years in high school. I did all my reports on it. You mentioned that you can only work on one page at a time. I don't recall having to do that. I wrote many 10 to 15 page papers and it handled them just fine. Watching the formatting and pagination was kind of fun. I'm curious how you will handle Atari Writer with its different versions released in different years. Can't wait for the next podcast. Well done." Thanks, KLund1, for the feedback. It's been fun looking back at all these old programs, and I'm looking forward to doing more. The terms for pages and documents gets confusing with Atari Word Processor because the document can consist of many pages, which are not necessarily representative of a single printed page. Pages would have been better named as sections because in reality the page is a section of the document the way Atari had it set up. Next up, Alan, via the InVersiTasky website on, again, Season 1, Episode 1 of Atari Word Processor, Alan writes, "Great review / podcast. Looking forward to more. I love the productivity software on the Atari 8-bits. It is something that gets shadowed by all the games. Glad they are getting some attention. Did you know that Atari Corp had contracted someone to write an office-like set of software but never released it?" He goes on to include a link for a review of the software. So the link points to a piece of software called Infinity by Matrix Software. This was a Lotus Symphony type of software, an all-in-one, and it was scheduled to be released at a price point of $49.95, which was quite a bit less than the competitors. It would have been a nice piece of software had it ever been released. The article has some very good information in it and is an interesting read. You should go check it out. I've updated that episode's show notes to include that. All right, next up is Siegfried via InVersiTasky website, Season 1, Episode 2, Letter Perfect. "I like your podcast, and it's a good complement for the other Atari podcasts. I used Letter Perfect, and later Data Perfect, during my senior high school years to write papers, etc. First on cart, and later on floppy. I can't really remember whether I used the upgrade option. It's good to be reminded how basic and sophisticated word processing was at the same time in the late 80s. One tends to forget that user interface basics like shift and move highlights were not invented yet, and every program had its own concepts and shortcuts. Looking back, less WYSIWYG probably resulted in more productive work, as you were not tempted to care more about correct indentations and graphical design of bullet points than about the actual contents. I agree with that. Of course, lacking the wisdom gained in the 30 years since, I totally fell for Signum on the ST, which had real fonts on screen and allowed you to move characters pixel by pixel. I can't recall whether I remember and used all those nifty cursor movement shortcuts, but I know that I don't bother to learn them today as I switch between different systems, and the lazy convenience of just having to grab a mouse to highlight some text keeps me from utilizing keyboard shortcuts, which would still allow for faster typing and editing. I did try a couple of other Atari Word processors later on, but they never even came close. That greater than 50% market share was well earned, and it's good to know that the company and author who wrote it are still in the software business. By the way, my Letter Perfect cartridge, about 1983/84 vintage, does not work on XEs, and Letter Perfect carts are listed as 400/800 only in the Atari FAQ. Thanks, Siegfried, for the feedback, and I do agree with you a lot on the WYSIWYG contributing to a loss of productivity, because we all do get caught up in what something is going to look like on paper, and then we tend to lose what we actually want to get written down. Next up is an email from Pete. "I really enjoyed the first show. Felt odd being interested in a show about productivity software, especially on a 30-plus-year-old platform, but you managed to grab my attention. Listening to the show got me thinking about my own Atari word processor usage. I had mainly used Atari Writer, but also had an unusual package called Richmond's Word Processor with 80-column support by Computer Software Services. It featured a software-rendered 80-column display that was surprisingly easy on the eyes. Years ago, I posted a quick blurb about it on Atari Age, and he includes a link. I included a couple of screenshots in the thread if you'd like to check it out. I'm sure I still have the program and instructions somewhere if you have any interest in reviewing the software. Let me know if you'd like to look at it, and thanks for the informative podcast, Pete. Well, Pete, as you already know, I have contacted you, and I do appreciate your feedback. I have the Richmond's 80-column word processor in my hot little hands, and I have booted it up on the 130XE and played with it. It is actually quite nice and does a great job of rendering the soft font. I will have a review for it at some episode later, but due to its release date, it will probably be far later rather than far sooner. So one of the things that's delaying this episode, aside from its release date, is the fact that I can't successfully get a good quality screenshot captured from it. The software has apparently never been broken, so there are no copies of it floating around except those that are on the original diskettes. So until I work out a way to capture the screen on the computer, I probably won't have very much of a review for it. I have also been in talks with the author for an interview, and he is open to it. All right, next up is Michael via email. Hello again. Got to listen to the new podcast on Letter Perfect. Sounds like a mighty little word processor, an impressive piece of software for its time. It does seem like it would have set a pretty high bar for other word processors to meet. And yes, an actual LJK DOS sounds like it would have been a fantastic product if Mr. Leonardi, I hope that's spelled correctly, and the gang had put their heads to it. Thanks to him and offering his insights, by the way. I just left a nice review on iTunes, which was the main reason I was writing. Don't be shy about asking for reviews. Thanks again for Inversitaski and keep up the good work. Well, thanks, Michael, for the nice words. It is Leonardi to be correct. I was more intrigued about the graphic OS, but sadly none of that stuff remains. I missed a clean out by about 7 months. Ken doesn't follow the Atari scene anymore and was shocked when people were still interested in it. I pointed him at a few neat things that are happening now. There are two things I haven't done yet with the podcast. One is the feedback request. Well, that's actually happening now. And the other is the inclusion of listener feedback, which is also happening now. I wanted to get a few episodes under my belt so I could draw on them first. Now that I have that, I will ask that people go out to iTunes and give me a review. Whether it's good or bad, hopefully it's good. And that concludes the listener feedback. I appreciate everybody who did provide feedback, and I encourage you to do so again in the future. And if you haven't already, please go out and do so now. Thank you.
Special thanks.
First, I'd like to thank everybody that's been listening and continued to tune in. I'd like to thank everybody that's followed me on Twitter, everybody that's liked the page on Facebook, and everybody that's commented on the website. And again, if you wouldn't mind, please go out and give me some feedback, whether it's good or negative. Hopefully it's good, and enjoy your day. Thank you.
Contact information.
The show notes can be found on inverseatascii.info. It can be found on iTunes using the search term Atascii or Atari. It can be found on Facebook at facebook.com/inverseatascii. And you can also follow on Twitter with @inverseatascii. To leave comments or suggestions, you can email wade@inverseatascii.info or inverseatascii@icloud.com. As always, thanks for listening and stay tuned for the next episode. Acasio F.
Goodbye. We'll be right back. ever said nasty. Atari 8-Bit Productivity Podcast, Season 1, Episode 4.
Hello, this is Wade, and welcome back. Hot on the heels of Episode 3 comes Episode 4. In this episode, we feature Atari Mailing List. Atari Mailing List was designed as an electronic card file, or Rolodex. You manage your address book or any other list you may have. It has two lists out of the box, one geared towards contact information like business cards, family members, addresses, and phone numbers, and a general list geared towards whatever you want to throw at it. It also gave you the ability to create customized lists should either of the canned ones not fit your needs.
Technical data.
Atari mailing list is part number CX4101, and it was released on cassette, if you didn't figure that out from the part number. It was a commercial licensed product by Atari, and I don't know who the programmer is. It required 24K of RAM, a basic cartridge, and a 410 cassette drive. A disk drive was optional, and if you used it, you needed a minimum of 32K. The original price was $19.99, but by 1985 it was down to $4.99. Today's price at the original listing would equate to $53.87. This was originally released on June of 1981. Atari Mania has it listed as a rarity of 7. And the manual is huge at 11 pages.
Usage notes.
Okay, this program shipped on one cassette, and it was on both sides. On the first side, you had the main program, which was mailing list, and it ran from tape counter 0 to tape counter 135. This program was the one that was originally intended for your business contacts or your family members, club memberships, that type of thing. If you flip the tape over and load the programs there, the first program on the tape runs from 0 to 136 on the tape counter, and that's your general mailing list. And it is supported of any other kind of data like recipes or inventories or whatever you want to stick in there. The second program on side 2 was the list customizer, and that ran from tape counter 136 to tape counter 208. Now this program, which we'll get into in a bit, just let you modify the number of fields and what field names were going to be there and how big the contents were supposed to be. And it created a list that you actually merged in with the main program and then resaved, which would give you a customized version of the mailing list to tailor to your needs. All right, so there are a couple of limitations here. First, the record count is limited to the number of records based on size that will fit into available memory. It does not read and write from disk or cassette as you move through records. So every entry has to fit in memory. Now, it's designed to work off of the cassette, and your data would be saved and loaded from a separate cassette. However, you can convert it to work off of disk. The manual even tells you how to do it. And once you do that, you'll be able to work with it just like you would with any other data file. Now, having said that, if you do convert it to work off a disk, you sacrifice some of your memory because DOS is going to be resident. All right, to start the program, you have to put the cassette in all the way rewound, make sure BASIC is inserted and it's turned on. Type in CLOAD, press return, the computer will beep, press play on the recorder, hit return again, and it will load. Once it's loaded, you type in run, and then it will force load the rest of the program in. If you've converted it to disk, then you would still boot it with BASIC installed, and at the prompt, you would type run, D colon, and then the name of however you saved it. And before I talk about the functions, I'm going to talk about the disk conversion. First, you boot with DOS disk and BASIC loaded. You do the normal CLOAD, but you don't run it. You have to remove lines 2005 and lines 8015. These each set the device name to C colon and call a routine at line 9720. If you look at the routine at 9720, it just prints a message on the screen about preparing the tape, and then it gets a keystroke and then it returns. After that, you save the program to disk using a name that you want. Note that the DOS you select is crucial to the amount of records you can store. I found SpartaDOS leaves the most bytes available to BASIC when using a standard 800XL. Okay, so why is the memory important? Well, if you boot an 800XL from cassette or without a cassette, with BASIC loaded and no diskette or no DOS, you have 37,902 bytes available. If you take that same 800 and boot with BASIC, but from SpartaDOS, you'll have 33,644 bytes available, roughly a 4K difference. So the program size for Atari mailing list is 15,963 bytes. You take that from the top of the free memory, 37902 or 33644, and in the case of booting from cassette, you end up with 21,939 bytes, and with SpartaDOS, you end up with 17,733 bytes. Now, this is the memory that your records get stored in. So that 4K, if you had 200 byte records, that represents about 20 records that you could have stored. Okay, so let's talk about the main menu. Once the program gets up and running, at the top of the screen, it'll show you how many records are in your data set. Then you have your menu below that. You have load, save, add, edit, delete, print, display, and sort. Those are all the different options, not necessarily in that order. Now, when working with the program, some of these operations result in different screen colors, as well as a label in the top left corner of the screen. For example, the menu is maroon, and when you go into add or edit, you get the standard Atari blue. But if you go into delete, you get a purple screen. And if you go into print, it's a similar maroon, but has a brighter border color than the menu does. All right, let's talk for a minute about record navigation. Print, display, edit, and delete allow for navigating all records or some records. Now, the some records gives you the ability to apply up to four conditionals to select records to display. Now, when you select these conditionals, it's going to ask you which field, the value you want to compare to, which is case sensitive, and what the conditional is, which is going to be either equal, not equal, greater than, or less than. After applying the first conditional, you have the ability to add up to three more, and you do this by pressing Option. Once you've applied all the conditionals that you want, you press Select to start the filtering. At any time, you can press Start to go back to the main menu. For either mode of either some records or all records, once the display set is being shown, you press the Option key to change the direction of navigation, either forwards or backwards, and you press the Select key to move one record at a time in that direction. You press Start at any time to go back to the main menu. Now, if you were doing Delete, you would press D while you're viewing the record that you want to delete, and then you'll be asked if you're sure you want to delete it. If you do delete it, it disappears and moves to the next record. Now, a quick word about sort. Sort only allows you to sort on one field. You pick it, it sorts it. It shows you an approximate amount of time, which is just that, an approximate amount, and it's kind of slow. Add, edit, and delete. When you add a record, you enter in each of the field's information, and when you get to the end, it'll give you a confirmation that the record was added. At that point, you press Select to add another one, or press Start to go back to the menu. Pretty easy. Edit works in a similar fashion to delete and print, in which you can select all records or you can select some records. So after you've decided which one you're going to do, you'll be presented with the first record in the data set. At that point, you can either edit it or go to the next record and edit that one and go to the next record and edit that one. If you were deleting, you would press D to delete those, like I've already discussed. That's about it for the editing functions. This program is basically useless unless you can save and load your data, because nobody's going to want to type it in every time they want to print it out. So with that, let's talk about save and load. If you're using the cassette version, each time you do a save or a load, you'll be presented with a prompt on the screen to prepare the tape. Now, if you're using cassette, you'll want to use your own tape for your data, and you'll also need to keep an index of which file is stored where on that tape. If you've converted to the disk, then all you need to do is enter in the file name and what disk drive it's on. To make the data useful, you need to be able to either look at it or print it out, and that's where we're at now. So choosing print from the menu gives you two options. You can display it to the screen, or you can choose to send it to the printer. If you choose to display it to the screen, it'll present it in a format similar to editing records, where you look at one record at a time and you press Select to move between those records and Option to change the direction. If you send it to the printer, you can get a nice multi-line formatted printout. That pretty much covers the functions available from Atari mailing list. Now let's talk about the meat and potatoes of customizing lists. Customizing lists is a five-step process in its simplest form. The customizer modifies 6 lines of the source code and saves it via list off to disk or cassette. It's noteworthy to mention here that it's just those 6 lines of code that are being modified that are saved. So every time you load the Atari mailing list, you'll need to enter those same lines of code before you run the program to get your customizations. Unless, of course, you save it back to your own source. The first step in customizing your list is to define a name. Then it's going to ask you how many fields per record and how many lines of output per record. You can have at most 10 fields per record and at most 25 lines of output per record. Seems kind of high on the output side, but whatever. The second step is to define each field name and each data size. Field names can be no longer than 6 characters. If you like things neat on the input side, keep the field data sizes no longer than 31 characters, although you can have up to 107. If you set it to 32 or greater, it'll wrap around the screen in an ugly manner. You want to keep these fields as short as possible to maximize the number of records that can be stored, since they must all fit in memory at the same time. The next step is to define the output format for each line. The manual makes this sound harder than it actually is. You don't have to create the format strings that it talks about. It creates them via questions. You get the option to embed literal text, and you can specify fields on a per-line basis. For fields, you can also choose to suppress trailing spaces or leave them in. Leaving them in may let you create nice columnar formatted data. Now, the formats that they talk about are a line number. You can have F and then a field number, and then a capital S to suppress, or a capital N to not suppress, and that's the indicator. You would embed a T with the literal text that you want to follow to embed literal text. Once you've defined each line of output, the next step is to save it. It will show you the program lines that it's modified on the screen and ask you if you want to save. If you're using the cassette, you'll enter NC colon and then do the save. If you're using disk, you'll enter D colon and the name of your choosing. Now for disk, don't use the name that you ultimately want it to be called, because you still need to merge this little code snippet into the program, and then you'll resave it as what you want it to be called. Now this last step is optional, but if you don't do it, you'll end up creating a lot of work for yourself each time you want to use your customized list. Load the mailing list program like normal, but don't run it. Now use the enter command to merge the program modification lines saved in the last step. Now you can save the program again to either cassette or to disk. When you save it to disk, use the name that you ultimately want to call it. And of course, you're probably going to use a .bas extension for BASIC. And you can do a save instead of a list to speed up load time in the future. Now from now on, you can simply load your customized program directly without having to modify the source.
Summary.
I couldn't find a lot to like about Atari mailing lists. It has limited customization, restricted field label lengths, and the number of fields, and the customization is just plain awkward. To start, a general complaint I have across many programs, and the Atari in general, is that the left column is left at the standard column 2. I don't know why Atari chose column 2. I'm sure there's a valid reason for it somewhere, and I don't know why any program would opt to keep it at column 2. There's 2 whole characters of wasted space, and when you only have 40, 2 is a lot. That's just a pet peeve of mine, and I'm going to move forward from it. So overall, this program is pretty slow, and not just a little bit. I don't like waiting for screens to draw, but this was written in BASIC, so I guess you get what you pay for. I didn't understand what all the screen color changing was about either, other than a visual cue to what mode you might be in. But it was inconsistent. Add and edit had no differentiation other than a label up in the top of the screen. And delete, I would expect to have been red. I don't know why they chose purple. Maybe they used purple because the menu was maroon. So why was the menu maroon? And why was print the same color as the maroon menu? Who knows? The biggest complaint I have about Atari mailing list is that you have to choose a mode for your editing. I would much rather have it dumped you into a navigational list where you would move left and right through your records and choose A to add.